Starlink did the one thing first that I thought was amazing, and that is, and I think everyone's seen the video of reusable rockets that land themselves autonomously. It's a useful service if you have enough money to afford it and you happen to live on the top of a mountain in Alaska. Well, maybe that's a bit too far north. No matter how remote you are, it will work and work brilliantly. Who owns space? Nobody. Once you're above that magic altitude, it depends on your country, but about 160 kilometers, everyone says it's not mine anymore. So whatever you do amongst yourselves at that height or higher is nobody's business but yours. The internet has enduring value. It's just a case of searching through the dross to get there. And that's not a governance problem. That's the way we regard it kind of problem. And as long as we keep that level of, I don't know, amazement, awe, and understand that beyond all the ads and cat videos, it is actually an astonishing resource, we'll be fine.
Hi, this is the Ripe Labs podcast. I'm Anastasia Park, and in this episode, we're going to delve into the topic of the satellite internet. Satellite internet is not a new technology, but it only became a mainstream topic when SpaceX brought it directly to customers with the promise of making the internet connection accessible no matter whether you're on a remote island or somewhere in the middle of the desert. SpaceX's Starlink uses low Earth orbit mega constellations to deliver broadband internet to customers across the globe. For just over 200 euros and a smaller service charge, you can purchase a hardware to connect at home, on the go, in the water, wherever. And they are ambitious. SpaceX aims to launch as many as 40,000 satellites in the near future. This groundbreaking technology is supposed to democratize access to the internet. Yet it's not very clear which regulations apply in space, and not every company can afford satellite constellations, and not every user can connect to Starlink. To get into these issues in more depth, I talked to chief scientist at APNIC, Jeff Houston. Jeff has done research and talks on satellite internet, having himself first explored the technology back in the late 80s, early 90s. We talked about those early attempts to bring satellite internet to Australia, the Starlink setup, and the standard internet protocol's performance on the Starlink network, as well as we touched on internet governance in the space. Before we tune in, please don't forget to subscribe and rate the Ripe Labs podcast on whichever platform you're listening it to. We would love to hear your feedback. So let's tune in. Normally we start with the introduction of the guest, but I think Jeff Houston doesn't need an introduction because everyone in the internet community knows who is Jeff Houston. So then I want to know instead, how did you actually become interested in the topic of the satellite internet?
You know, living in Australia, as I do, when we were first building the internet in Australia in 1989, 1990, the problem was, of course, that all the content was not in Australia. And in essence, what we had to do was drag everything in. And of course, an isolated country in the bottom end of the South Pacific, the best way to do that, oddly enough, was actually over satellite. And the first connections that we got to the internet as a national academic and research network in 1989 was a 56 kilobit analog connection, modems at either end, off an Intelsat spacecraft using hemispherical transponders. Now, I can say all that because, you know, you really had to study it hard to try and get the optimal price and to try and get the optimal configuration and so on. You needed to kind of understand a fair deal about what was then a relatively small and specialized business. And we ran over satellite 3 years, I'll have a stab at. I think we were doing 768 kilobits per second on satellite, but then we ran out of satellite capacity. They just, at the time, didn't do big transponders. This was quite old. And we found some old telephone cable. Well, it wasn't old, it was what people used, and shifted the load across to two cables, which were electro-optical. They were pre-fiber-based optical amplifiers. So these things were kind of, they went under the water for a while, and then you had to do a repeater that was electronic. And so there was a real limit to how much capacity you had. the total cable, I think, was 500 megabits per second. And again, we started running into trouble with capacity because, you know, whatever capacity you put in, it eats it. And then we started experimenting a bit with a different kind of satellite connection. Odd intro, but let me finish the story. We noticed that we were pulling traffic, not pushing. We were consumers. And the satellite companies would sell us what they called symmetrical capacity. So if you ordered 1.5 megabits or whatever, you got it in both directions. And one direction was screamingly hot, and the other one was, you know, doing nothing. And so I came up with a neat technique of doing unidirectional satellites. So we only bought one direction, half the price, bargain, from Earth stations. The Earth station was in Vancouver, I think, in Canada. But we did a beam up from Canada, bounced off an Intelsat spacecraft down into Australia, and then ran the reverse connection on the submarine cables back into the US and threaded its way through the internet and up to Canada. And if you do it right and carefully control BGP keeper lives, then oddly enough, this unidirectional circuit will, if you will, signal that it's down when it is down, and when it comes back up, you know, it'll signal that it's up again. So it was quite successful for about, oh, a couple of years or so, until we found some more recent cables and a whole lot more capacity.
So basically, you brought the satellite internet to Australia way before Elon Musk did.
Satellites were around for quite some time, but the issue is that they were expensive. They were very expensive, and the ITUT had a rule that said you weren't allowed to share. We obviously broke that rule because we were sharing with every Australian university and, you know, the academic and research community all around the world. But the problem is, if you couldn't share, you couldn't be big enough to afford it.
So the satellites are very expensive, and like 30 years later, Starlink actually brought this to a mainstream level and made them a bit more affordable. What was like the history of the satellite networks pre-Starlink then?
Let's just discuss some of this a bit more and understand why geostationary satellites were so expensive. And the problem is that there's only a narrow band in the sky at that altitude directly above the equator. If you crowd that and put the satellites beside each other, when you beam the signal up, the neighboring spacecraft might get the signal. You go, well, move to another frequency. You're not allowed, because the ITUR, the folk who coordinate the use of spectrum, only gave a limited set of bands of spectrum for use in satellite communication. And the result is you've got to separate these spacecraft in a geostationary orbit by around 2 degrees. Now, you've got 360 degrees, but you're separating it by two. There's only about 180 slots available. And the bandwidth available on the Ka band is not that high. So they're expensive because more people, if you will, had demand than there was capacity to supply. The advantage of geostationary is once you're up that high, you see half the Earth, pole to pole, you know. And so if you had three of them up there, equidistantly spaced, there will always be a geostationary satellite within sight. You'll need a big dish, but you know, you will get a service. And certainly the television companies used it a lot. And there are some data services in very remote areas where, you know, this kind of worked. Now, if we advance the story on a bit, the next entrants in that were the Motorola project, Iridium.
Yeah, the
And
one
this was
that was cancelled, right? That they got bankrupt or.
Iridium was a daring plan by the radio engineers at Motorola. And it was a brilliant plan. Relatively small spacecraft. I think they were at 600 and so kilometers up. So relatively high up, but nowhere near as far away as geostationaries. They were relatively low in the sky. And it was meant to be a global phone service. And you needed a special phone. It wasn't a mobile. You needed something with a big antenna with enough power. But the problem was that all the telephone companies on the earth were deeply, deeply, deeply suspicious. Their theory, and I worked for one of the telephone companies at the time, was that Motorola would make all of its money in somewhere else, America, some other market. So when they were flying over our country, name your country, they had nothing to lose. They were making all their money somewhere else, so they would offer this service, in our country for free. So all the phone companies said, "We're not going to give you a spectrum license to operate in our country." And so even before the last satellite in this constellation was launched, Motorola had just figured out that they'd blown about $30 billion, and it was never, ever, ever going to work.
And
And
which
so they were
years
sitting
we're
there
talking
going,
about? We're talking about.
geez, now you're pushing my memory. I'm thinking late 70s, early 80s. No, later. I'm trying to think when all these meetings were, where we all panicked. And it was actually 99, 2000, 2001. These things were up there. They had 25 gallons of hydrazine, but no one was willing to pay for it down on the earth. They weren't willing to give them spectrum licenses. So Motorola scratched their head a bit and said, "What are we going to do?" And so they threatened. They sort of said, "Well, okay, well, US, you're using it, US government, do you want to buy it?" And they said, "No." "Well, we're going to let them burn up then. We're going to kill it. We're going to bring it down and burn them because you can't leave space junk up there." And there was panic, particularly in the FCC and various parts of the military parts of the US, because, from the US perspective, having a handheld device that communicated anywhere on the planet was brilliant. They just didn't want to run it themselves. And so eventually it was sold for the bargain basement price of, I think, 30 million or something, just a
Oh, and they spent
giveaway.
like 60, you said,
30
or
billion.
psst, oh,
Billion.
okay. Oh, wow.
Okay, there's a massive loss. But Motorola walked away. Google bought Motorola eventually, and now we've all forgotten about all this. But oddly enough, Iridium, I think there was still spacecraft up there.
So then there is geostationary orbit and the low Earth orbit, which is way closer to the Earth. And that's where Elon Musk placed his satellites. And it's above 160 kilometers from the Earth.
Above 160
60.
kilometers, and you'd like to get a bit higher. Because during solar storms, the Earth kind of inflates outwards to 200, 250 in the worst case. So you want to be above that, right? The further you are up, though, the more the signal from Earth gets attenuated. So too far, and if your dream is to take handheld mobile phones and get them to communicate with the satellite, if that's your dream, and Elon certainly has that dream, you can't go too high. You just can't, because the signal attenuation will again inevitably get you. So there's this sort of sweet spot at around 400 to around 600-ish, which is probably optimal. And Starlink itself is setting its first sort of constellation at 550, right? But don't forget, every single sort of spacecraft only sees a 900 kilometer radius. So if I wanted to have a service that was continuous, then as one satellite drops below the horizon, another one's got to appear all the time. So at a minimum, at that altitude, you need 500 satellites.
Can we go back a little bit? Like, let's say you are talking to a person who absolutely knows nothing about Starlink. Could you explain how it actually works? What is the setup? So there is this dish, there is the satellite, there is many of them, they move very fast.
Well, Starlink is a retail service. So it's not that your ISP bought Starlink. You're buying the internet from Starlink at the moment. That's the service. So when, and your country needs to have signed up. If your country hasn't signed up, there ain't no service. But if it has, you can then order a Starlink, what they call a dishy. Now, dishy is a relatively small flat plane. It contains inside it, I think, around 300 small antenna. And it is just a
A pizza
flat.
size, right?
Yeah, it's about, well, I don't know. I've got my hands gesticulating, but if you're listening on a podcast, let me make this about 0.5 meter long and about less than slightly less than 0.5 meter wide. So it's a big square, not a very big square, but just a square. And for the best results, Maybe you should put it on a roof or somewhere that's got not an absolutely clear view of the sky, but a fair deal of the sky. The more, or so the less sky you can see and the more trees are around, the worse the signal to some extent. So, okay, you put out your dishy, right? It comes with an Ethernet jack, and that's got power over Ethernet, PoE. So you take that, and it comes with a long cable. And you've also bought the Starlink modem, which you put in your house and applied power to. You plug Dishy into the modem. You plug your household Ethernet into the other port on the modem. You are connected. Full stop. That's it. Plug, plug, plug. Done. So it's incredibly simple. So what's going on underneath this? Well, that Dishy is actually controlled by Starlink. You can't
Right.
program it, they do. And it uses a very clever form of electronics called phased array antenna. And instead of that flat dish swiveling around with little servo motors going track, 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 it does move slightly, but most of the focusing on the spacecraft above it is actually controlled by Starlink, and it's done using phased array movements. All these little antenna are slightly off phase with each other, and that focuses that flat dish on a particular part of the sky, the part of the sky where they're focusing on that spacecraft, right?
So you could be anywhere
So,
in the world and basically just install this Dishi and then get access to the internet.
well, if you're at the poles above, I think basically the Arctic Circle and the Antarctic Circle, life is not so simple. There are some services that go polar, but all the rest are in inclined orbit between, basically between the Arctic and the Antarctic Circle. And all you need to do is put a dishy outside in your yard, plug in Ethernet, and you're done. Or if you're feeling adventurous, as folk have done, you remove or saw off the arm of the dishy, mount it on the roof of your car, and head off, supplying car battery power to it, and it just works. I'm not sure how legal it is in some countries because you've gone mobile, but basically Starlink doesn't care and doesn't matter. Don't forget, these things are flying past at literally 27,000 kilometers an hour.
Yeah.
From that perspective, anything on the surface of the Earth looks like it's standing still, right? I'm going 100 kilometers an hour. Well, good for you, but it doesn't matter. So yes, you could kind of, it doesn't need to be fixed, and people have done it, boats, cars, whatever. And the latest thing is they are announcing initial deals with mobile providers, which is subtly different. They're actually going for the wholesale carrier market and saying it won't be brilliantly quick, it won't be 5G, but it will be wherever you can see the sky and you're holding your handset. And it's kind of, wow, that's amazing. Starlink did the one thing first that I thought was amazing, and that is, and I think everyone's seen the video of reusable rockets that land themselves autonomously. Now, instead of making a vast pressure chamber with intricate machinery, electronics, motors, blah blah blah, sending it up and then burning it up, they bring it back and do it again, and that system. With their Falcon 9 and now the Falcon Heavy, it's dropped the launching cost per kilo. So if you look at things like, Ariane, who's out there now, Electron, and a whole bunch of the others, the Chinese Long March, they're between $10,000 to $20,000 a kilo to get payload into low Earth orbit. Starlink is 1,500. The way this works is absolutely fascinating. With that many satellites right now, a mere 5,000, if you were going to look up in the sky, you would see at least 40 and maybe 50 of them traveling overhead.
From
Now,
every
it'd need to
corner of the
be,
world.
no matter where you are, yes, it's just no matter where you are, that's what you will see. And there are lots of photos of folk doing it at night or at least in the evening when the sun is just right, when it can sort of catch the satellites, but you're dark, so you'll see these beads of light, and they move pretty quickly. Horizon to horizon, I think is around 11 minutes. You know, it's pretty fast. You don't try and connect to all of them.
Yeah.
You only connect to one. But which one you connect to is controlled by Starlink Central, you know, the controller inside Starlink. And so the dishy and the satellite effectively lock onto each other. They probably encrypt. Starlink don't say an awful lot about their technology. And for exactly 15 seconds, no less, no more, at a switching time of 2 minutes, 2 seconds, 17 seconds, 32 seconds, they're very precisely timed. You're instructed to lock onto one satellite, and
Right.
then 15 seconds later, you lock onto another and another. So every 15 seconds,
Seconds.
you actually lock onto a new satellite and continue your merry way. Now, at the moment, most of the satellite services are what we call mirrors, or is mirrored in the sky. So you need to be relatively close to a ground station, 900 kilometers. And that satellite you lock onto is also locked onto an Earth station run by Starlink around or somewhere between, you know, where you are and about 1,000 kilometers away. And so the signal you send up gets received by that Earth station, gets dropped into the internet, and signals coming to you go to that Earth station, get fed up to a satellite and back down to you.
So does it mean they have several Earth stations then across the
Oh,
world?
they have several thousand. They're not very big. If you look at the pictures of them, you know, I was going to say dog kennel size, but I'm not sure that means much to your listeners. But, you know, imagine kind of, yeah, a meter square or something. They're not an amazingly big facility. They're actually quite modest. You need power and you need connection to the internet. But, you know, they too use phased array antennas. So the stuff is simple and quite sort of small. So that's the way their deployment is. But more is coming.
Now we talk about the way it works. I want to discuss a bit about its performance because you presented at the RIPE meeting and you were discussing the performance of Starlink. And you said in the end that basically most of the things we do on the internet is fine if you use the Starlink. And I guess it could be a very good solution for those where there is no connectivity. But what are the limitations of its network?
There were a group in Sweden some years ago who, some drunken bet, I'm sure. Someone had written an RFC some years before saying we can do IP over carrier pigeons. And it was an idle drunken night, I think. But then the Swedes, who were equally drunk, decided to implement it. And bizarrely, they did. It does work. But outside of carrier pigeons, I'd have to say that Starlink is one of the most hostile communications environments we've ever had to use. Part of the problem is that if you think about it, here is this dish pointing sort of upwards,
Yeah.
but what's happening above your head is this beam pointed at you that's moving past you very, very quickly. And so you get the fringe of the beam, you get the focus of the beam, and then you get the fringe. So in signal to noise terms, low signal, high signal, low signal, again and again and again. Now, when the signal quality is poor, you get high bit error rates. And what that means is you get a higher incidence of packet drop. And so the first thing is Starlink is lossy. There is a lot of packet drop, but it's not because you're pushing too much traffic. It's because of the characteristics of the signal. The next thing is to try and correct a few things, smooth it out, and also because of the varying signal to noise. The latency, the delay to go to the Earth station, connect to somewhere close, and send it back. So you traverse the link twice. The latency is incredibly unstable. Unstable. This is what we call really high jitter. Really high. You never see high jitter on cable-based systems, fiber or copper, and you hardly ever see jitter in mobile. But in this case, you're seeing a huge amount of variation. And the jitter component, you know, varies between the very best times of 20 milliseconds and the very worst times of 100 milliseconds. So it's kind of 20 milliseconds, 2 hundredths of a second up to 1/10 of a second. Protocols hate this. Because you see, when I send you a packet, I normally start a little timer if I'm the sender, and I wait for your response. And if you don't send me a packet back within the time that I think you should, I think everything is broken and send it again. Because that's the way protocols work. I send you a packet, tick, tick, tick. Oh, nothing back. Send it again because it's obviously got lost. Oh, I got an answer. This is great. So that feedback loop, we normally put timers on to make sure that we can quickly react when the packet gets lost, right? But when the time to send and receive this packet varies like crazy, the protocol kind of goes, ugh. And normally protocols kind of, when they go, ugh, start to go slower and slower and slower because they kind of stretch out to the worst case. So you've got the two enemies of protocol performance. You've got relatively high latency, 50 to 100 milliseconds. It's not like geostationary, two-thirds of a second, but it's still high. It's about the same, for example, as talking from Western Europe across to America or so. It's that kind of latency. So it'd be a lot faster if you're just going across the country. And secondly, though, to make it a killer, it's really, really high jitter. And so normally the protocols are just being hammered. And then to make it worse, loss is random. It's not congestion based. You'll lose packets because you just lost a packet, because signal to noise ratio, very fast moving satellites. So if you were going to tailor a protocol for Starlink, you would not start with TCP the way we know it. You just wouldn't. You would actually tailor a protocol that effectively reconfigured itself every time you locked into a new satellite. So every 15 seconds, it's a new story. So you'd have this constant shift at the transport level going lock in, lock in, lock in. Secondly, you would not be loss sensitive. Loss is not the problem. You just simply do a large retransmission window and keep going full pace. And thirdly, you'd be, jitter tolerant. But you could do that. But we just talked about the retail service. I'm at home. You're sending me traffic. Neither of us are really aware that we're using Starlink or not, right? And so you're using whatever came in your browser. I'm using whatever came in my browser. We're using standard TCP. And so neither of us have the opportunity to tune the protocol.
I see.
So when you start analyzing the performance of Starlink, you don't use a customized, optimized for Starlink performance analyzer. You actually just run traffic over it. So speed test is actually slightly deceptive because the standard kind of speed test measurements, to be nice to you, don't jam the link with traffic. They try and simulate the performance by sending a smaller number of packets and very carefully judge the timing. If you really want to understand how Starlink works, send traffic. Send an enormous pack. Send as much traffic as Starlink can cope with and see how it reacts. And that's been an interesting course of action, because there are protocols that really sing and dance with Starlink and protocols that really don't. But most of the world, up until about a year or two ago, in the age before BBR and QIC, and even in the QIC age, a lot of them still use a protocol called CUBIC. CUBIC is a traditional, what can I say? It's congestion-based, loss-based algorithm. Push the network until you lose packets. Oh, I've lost a packet. Back off and try again. When you lose packets at random, you spend all your time backing off. Oops, go slower. Oops, go slower. Oops, go slower. And it's very, very hard for CUBIC to kind of get a full head of steam when packets are being dropped at random. And so you may get decent performance out of Starlink running CUBIC, but equally, you may not. It depends on when loss occurs inside your sort of spectrum of use. So it's not the best of protocols. And, some performance measurements, and I reported in Wright on this sort of 250 odd megabit service from Starlink, by the end of about a minute, poor old Cubic had dropped down to 40 megabits a second, and it was struggling. It's kind of, God, I wish I could go faster, but I keep on getting lost. On the other hand, there's this more recent protocol, more recent being a mere 10 years old. Yeah. Geez, that long. BBR. And BBR developed originally by Google and used within Google's Qwik and by some other folk. There's certainly a lot of interest in BBR. BBR is not sensitive to loss. It just isn't. And even high jitter environments, BBR does a better, far, far better job than Cubic. And so if you're running BBR on a circuit that'll, you know, claim at around 250, BBR pretty typically over a minute is still running at upwards of 200 megabits a second because it's BBR. And BBR is quite aggressive in the way it sort of grabs hold of bandwidth and uses it. The right transport protocol makes this thing sing and dance. You and I as users,
yeah,
we don't have a choice. We don't have a choice. Do you know who determines the protocol? The server, the deliverer of data, not the receiver.
Yeah.
So even if I'm running a browser at home and I configure it up to run BBR, etc., that doesn't matter unless I'm sending you data. If you, the server, if you, yeah, YouTube, whatever, are sending me data, then it's their call as to what to use. BBR works and works very well, but very aggressive. And so some folk are reluctant to kind of move to BBR because it would becomes an arms race in elbowing everyone else off the network.
Let's summarize here. So if traditional TCP mechanisms are not efficient with the satellite internet, what needs to be taken into account for the protocols used in the satellite networks?
Don't get me wrong. They can work surprisingly well even so. And in most tests, once you run it for a while, you'll be unlucky to come down to that 50 megabits. Most of the time, it will sit at about 100, 150 megabits. So if you are a speed freak, even with Cubic, most of the time, you'll be a happy little camper and you'll get data through. If the advertised rate is 250, you'll need to use something else to get right the way up there. But, you know, it works well.
But if we think of an alternative protocol, what will be the main features of it that needs to be taken into account?
Well, it's everything that BBR is and that Cubic isn't. You need to be insensitive to loss. And there's actually quite a lot of thinking around that because the old school mechanism of driving the network bucket buffers into loss, God, I'm trying to think of the right analogy. It's crude, it's primitive, it's banging the rocks together. Because you don't make really high efficiency networks by driving the network into paranoid overdrive and then backing off and then overdrive and backing off.
Sounds
this
stressful.
Just makes everything. Right, try doing that to your car and see how long it lasts, right? It's the same thing with networking. What you actually want to do, and this is where BBR had the theory right, you want to drive your sending rate just at the point where network queues start to form. And if you see them forming, back off a bit. So you're keeping the wire full, or in this case, the circuit to the satellite and down, you're keeping that part as full as you can, but you're not backlogging traffic anywhere. If you can do that, then you're smooth, you're efficient, and you're sort of getting the most out of the network with not kind of wasting anything. So Cubic was sort of in that whole loss-based congestion was sort of a first attempt in the 1980s, really, to try and get a feedback flow control mechanism. BBR, I think, advanced that thinking by a generation, but not everyone runs BBR. And as I said, in a world where there's mixed Cubic and BBR, I run BBR because, you know, selfishly, I elbow Cubic out of the way and it's not my Cubic. And I'm not sure everyone likes me doing that, you know, me doing that because I'm not social. And when you start to think about, well, how do you get on with Cubic? BBR is not necessarily the answer. Now, if we all ran BBR, it would be a different world and it will probably would be a better world, but, you know, we don't. So, you know, that transport evolution, which is its own topic, is going to take still quite some time. But we're all putting in gigabits. We're all raising the bar. Starlink is raising the bar too. It's putting in bigger satellites with more power. If you have more power, the signal-to-noise ratio improves, and oddly enough, the achievable bandwidth improves. Also, if you have 40,000 odd spacecraft, my God, the amount of bandwidth you can bang at any point in the Earth is starts to become awesome. And so, with the right protocols, you can get really, really high capacity, even from space.
And how do you measure the performance, like the capacity of Starlink? Because I've seen some researchers have been using Rep Atlas. They were, I think they did some trace routes measurements. So I'm curious, what is like the standard measurement kind of tool
Oh,
for?
trace route just doesn't get to it. You actually need to do sustained TCP with a reasonable amount of clarity. These days, Intel started it with what they call network computers, NUCs. There are a whole bunch of folk that make relatively small, sort of single blade computers with a decent processor, not a huge amount of memory, but some. And a couple of my mates around the world have very generously given me access to one of those network computers, a little Linux box, directly at the other end of Starlink. I now have
Exclusive access.
well, it's kind of, yes, exclusive access. They're using it too, and so we try not to tread on each other's toes. But I've then got something that can send and receive using a variety of transport protocols across the immediately adjacent Starlink. So what I do then is I use network VMs, and network VMs are everywhere, and try and sort of hire a network VM close to where I think the Earth station is. And the tools I use are pretty typical tools for performance measurement, IPERF-3 or IPERF. It really doesn't matter. And what that is kind of a stress tester. It runs TCP flat chat, or at least as fast as the protocol will let it. It's not trying to send anything from the file system. It just makes up data. But it pushes that link as fast as the protocol will let it be pushed. And what I do then to make sure I understand what's going on, full packet capture, analyze the timing of the packets, and then figure out what's going on with both performance and loss, and relate that together. So, there's a fair deal of maths involved in the resultant analytics. And it's a lot more than trace route. What I'm trying to find out is, does that high jitter and the almost random loss, how do these standard TCP protocols and BBR react to that? How do their congestion windows behave when you get kind of that kind of external impost?
I see.
So yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And certainly I think it's telling us a lot about transport protocols as much as it's telling us about Starlink.
And the next question, I think it's no less important, and it's security considerations. How does satellite internet ensure data security and privacy during transmission, if you know?
Well, the problem was certainly a much bigger problem with the geostationaries because they had antenna that listened over a large part of the Earth. And if your transmissions were not encrypted, then anyone could beam a signal up and interfere with the folk who were legitimately using the spacecraft. And because, in essence, some of these transponders were aimed at the entire hemisphere, then anyone could sort of beam a signal upwards and interfere with legitimate use. So very quickly, A, they use spot beams from the geostationaries, and B, they encrypt it, because that way you could fend off some of this traffic. But jamming is still a problem, just overwhelming the spacecraft with, non-signal spectrum will cause it to have problems. Now, the issue about Starlink and any other low Earth orbiting system is that you need to tuck in to the same radius as the spacecraft sees on the Earth. So you and the intended victim and the space this yeah this the low Earth orbiting spacecraft need to be close together in geography. You can't do this from a long, long way away. You've got to be in tight in order to sort of look at the right spacecraft. But no one knows, only Starlink, which of the 40 or so that are visible to me, and soon to be 400, I am using. So if you want to disrupt me, and no one else but me, you've got a bit of a problem. You either beam noise across everything everywhere, but to have enough power to disrupt that, you need an awful lot of power beamed over a really wide range. And that's kind of, I'm not sure if it's a physical impossibility, but it's hard, right? It's challenging. Secondly, of course, it's encrypted. Why wouldn't you? We've long since learned you can't do open transmission over radio. So, a bit like encrypted Wi-Fi these days, of course, it's encrypted. And so that's part of the armory, right? What they also want to do is stop rogue Starlink dishes hooking into Starlink. And the other part of this too is that the way Starlink do this is that they aim dishy from Starlink Central. That whole every 15 seconds you get scheduled to a new satellite, that's not a decision you made at home. It's not your equipment selecting which Starlink to track. It's a directive from on high, from the other end of the link as to where you're tracking. So you need to exchange credentials, prove you're a paying customer, all the usual things before you get assigned Starlink slots and start to use it. So there's a fair few layers of protection, both self-protection, protection against jamming, and of course basic encryption services that are used to protect this.
But if their
So is it
systems break, then it means that it becomes like everyone becomes very vulnerable, right?
Well, let's think about this for a second. Every Earth station is independent of every other. There are a few points of vulnerability, and certainly one could speculate about the routing system. They use a single AS, there's a single block of addresses. There are certain points where, well, of course they do. Addresses aren't infinite. Everyone's
That's true.
struggling.
No, like about
That's true.
routing. I didn't know that they use a single, okay, but
Well,
yeah.
they don't use a single address, but they've got a single block announced from a single AS, So, there are points of vulnerability, but in the space connections, no. My view of Starlink here in Australia at this time of the night is entirely different to yours. They're different satellites. They're at the other side of the world. And so disrupting me doesn't disrupt you, and disrupting you, even if you achieve it, doesn't disrupt me. So, in that respect, the system is astonishingly resilient because, everything is bounded geographically because of the way Starlink works. Where it's vulnerable is the standard vulnerabilities around routing, et cetera, but everyone shares that fate, fortunately or unfortunately.
Well, also, are there any environmental concerns about the satellites being out there?
Well, if you were an optical astronomer used to peering through a telescope at night, you would find if you took a time exposure that you're seeing a grid, a dense grid of sort of tracks of these satellites across your field of vision. And certainly there were early objections, and I think SpaceX changed the nature of the solar panels to try and be less reflective. But there's only so much you can do. And if the Chinese and Amazon and everyone else have their way with 500 million of these things in a low Earth orbit, that's a pretty dense field. And once they're up there, they're up there. The bigger problem, is that if they crash into each other and there's enough of them, we will start a chain reaction. Because the speeds, 27,000 kilometers an hour for low Earth orbit, if two of them are traveling in opposite directions, that's 57,000 kilometers an hour of collision. That's an extraordinary amount of fragmentation going on when they collide. That bubble of debris at that altitude then becomes a problem for every other spacecraft. And there is this continued sort of murmuring in this industry that if we put too many things up there and they accidentally smash into each other, we will pollute this valuable resource to the point that it will be unusable forever. So, the concern is this is a unique resource, absolutely unique. And if you smash things together often enough, atmospheric nuclear tests in the 60s, that debris is still up there. It really is. No one thought it would be a problem. Wow, it's a problem. So that's the biggest one. As to all that space stuff up there, well, as long as you've got propellant and as long as you haven't smashed into anything else, when you've got no further use in it, drive it down. And if you propel it down, it'll hit the atmosphere. A lot of heat will get generated. It will get burned to a crisp. But like I said, the real problem is crowding and fragmentation problems if they ever start colliding with each other. NORAD, American, does do an astonishing work with tracking almost everything of any significance that's up there, and the database is public. And there's a coterie of folk, enthusiastic hackers, of which I am not one. But I have looked at the code and played with it, and my God, there is an astonishingly big database of exactly where everything is right now.
Oh,
and you
wow.
can do amazingly pretty maps of, you know, where is all the Starlink, where is all this, where is the debris, because NORAD makes the data public and they are tracking this stuff because collisions are a problem for everyone. So I'll tip my hat off to NORAD saying, thank you for coordinating. The data is so cool.
And now let's move on to my favorite topic, which is the governance. People say that services like Starlink can democratize the access to the internet, but also mostly large American companies like SpaceX, Amazon, Boeing, etc. run the LEO satellites. So who owns the space?
Let's unpack this sort of bit by bit. Who owns space? Nobody. Once you're above that magic altitude, it depends on your country, but about 160 kilometers, everyone says, it's not mine anymore. So whatever you do amongst yourselves at that height or higher is nobody's business but yours. And so when Starlink set up inter-spacecraft laser links to beam a signal across the Earth from space, they're not breaking anybody's rules because there are none. In that respect, you're in international outer space. Laws come into effect, national laws, when you effectively beam the signal back to Earth and try and pick it up on the surface of the Earth, because in general, somebody owns that bit of Earth.
Yeah.
And so it's the spectrum licenses, country by country, that regulate where and how Starlink is available. But up there, it's a free-for-all. You go, well, this is all American. And the answer is, well, not quite. If you look at some of the plans and some of the owners, Web One, which is out there, a slightly different service, slightly higher. It's almost a medium Earth orbit rather than a low. And that, I think the UK went and bought it out of bankruptcy there for a while. And certainly there was a different set of owners. It wasn't just American.
Yeah.
Different model. Wholesale, not retail. And the Chinese have certainly been leaking their intentions to launch a similarly massive, massive constellation of their own low Earth orbiters. But the details are sketchy. And I suppose the difference, even Amazon's plans with Kuiper, is still hot air. Unless Amazon obtain launch capacity on Falcon, on SpaceX's launch vehicle, they're going to be paying five times the price to get their hardware into orbit. And that's going to be a killer. So in some ways, that reusable rocket technology that I stress I've only ever seen used by SpaceX is almost the golden leverage that keeps, at this point in time, SpaceX in a very, very privileged position.
So it's going to make them a monopolist base.
Yeah. Now, again, let's not get too carried away here. The amount of capacity up there is not infinite. There's only a certain amount of satellite spectrum you can use. It's the Ka and Ku bands, I think. And if you sort of do the sums, and if you tried to provide service to London or Paris, you can't. You can't, because you can't bring that much spectrum to that smaller geography efficiently. Today, the fibers going into those major metros, the aggregate is, you know, close to a terabit or two. You cannot pull that from space. The space system works well for lower density. So smaller places, widely dispersed, it's fantastic. Highly concentrated populations, you're joking. You know, just cannot do that this way. It never happened. Will it service the billion or so who can afford it? It's not cheap.
Yeah.
Dishes aren't given away. Are those who are paying typically in US dollar terms, somewhere between 50 and 100 bucks a month, probably closer to 100. Yes, it's fantastic. But, you know, of the 8 billion, who can afford $50 to $100 US a month for their service? Mm-hmm. So you kind of look, it's a premium system. And to start talking about monopolies is, I think, sort of making the assumption that somehow it will get dirt cheap. Unlikely, because of the limitations of spectrum, etc. So it's a useful service, if you have enough money to afford it and you happen to live on the top of a mountain in Alaska, or maybe that's a bit too far north, a top of the mountain in Indonesia or in Papua New Guinea or somewhere, down close to the equator, you're laughing. No matter how remote you are, it will work and work brilliantly. Does the US have a preeminent position? Yes, it does. And I actually argue in some ways, the NASA program, the bid to actually do the moonshot in the 60s, put a culture in America in that period and raised an entire generation of advanced engineering knowledge, industrial capacity, and technological capacity, and an economy of innovation, which no other country or community even recognized was going on. They hit the 70s with this extraordinary amount of talent, extraordinary amount of expertise, and had leveraged the invention of the integrated circuit and were just running into an empty space. Were they just, lucky? I guess it was an early adopter advantage. And in an open market sense, fine. But it did leave everyone else kind of struggling to catch up. Absolutely. And I would put the issues, they happened, in the late 50s, early 60s. And we are still, 70 odd years later, living that legacy.
So the internet is the vital resource for people right now, I think. And if we talk about cutting digital divide, as I understand, only a few then decide who gets access to the internet. So, and it also can get politicized because, for instance, like the war in Ukraine, like Starlink's involvement, etc. So do you think the governments need to control the operation of the satellite internet, or is it something that the technical community actually needs to start discussions about?
Well, in some ways, governments have no say. They said it was out of space. They said it was out of space. You can't go, oh, no, sorry, sorry, somehow, somebody, I wonder who it might be, owns out of space. God, really? Truly? You serious? That's not the issue. Even this whole thing about the digital divide, let's unpack that. I don't know about you, but over the last 10 years, the cost to me in Australia of an internet connection has gone up by a speed factor of somewhere between 1,000 and 1,000,000 times faster. And my cost has come down, down. So, the challenge is, well, what's the problem? I'm like, if it's the cost per megabit, it's now scary small. And part of the reason why is this isn't the internet we built 30 years ago. And oddly enough, even Starlink almost has no role. Almost all of the traffic on today's internet comes from a data center that if you opened your window and looked out, you would see where it is. It's close, really close. So if you look at the internet in terms of packet miles, the number of miles a packet has to get to you, we have shrunk from it came around the world, as my early days in academic networking, 7,000, 8,000 miles away, 20,000 kilometers. It came down from that to 10. If cost equals distance squared, and it does in networking, distance is the killer. Distance makes it expensive, it makes it slow, it makes it inefficient. If I shrink my network of where I pull data from 10,000 kilometers to 10, it's 1,000,000 times faster and 1,000,000 times cheaper. 1,000,000. So in some ways, this technology, coupled with content distribution networks, has been astonishingly prodigious. It's actually creating a network that is so cheap that almost the entire population of India can afford to use it. And so you sort of go, well, the digital divide. And I am struggling to some extent to understand the nature of the divide in the face of these kinds of massive changes. As the cost of storage and processing gets cheaper, and these days under Moore's law, unlike the old days of telephony and even satellites, which was an economy of scarcity and rationing and exuberant pricing, we now have an economy of massive abundance. There's a supercomputer in your pocket. There's one in mine. There's a terabyte worth of storage. The amount of data I could pack into my phone beggars belief. And it's kind of, what's the problem here that we're trying to solve that we haven't already solved? So in some ways, I think a lot of these issues around the digital divide, governance, and so on, and these terrible folk who are monopolizing the internet, are kind of struggling with a network that has already disappeared 15 years ago. The network we have today is not that network. And the quality and efficiency of what we're delivering, and that does include Starlink with the role, is now, if you will, scary good. And the one thing that I am looking for Starlink to do, which I must admit would make the entire CDN industry panic, is what would happen if you put a petabyte of data into those orbiting spacecraft? And instead of the CDN being 10 kilometers down the street, the CDN is in 40,000 spacecraft just up there. And it's kind of an interesting thought. And it certainly challenges the Earth-based industry to go better, faster, cheaper, because it's feasible to do petabytes up there, which kind of puts a ceiling on how expensive the Earth can get, because the space-based CDN is certainly sitting there going, well, if you push us, we could. We really could. And at that point, you know, things would get even more interesting in terms of, you know, the basic cost of this kind of service, how good it is, how ubiquitous it is. Because I think, you know, there's more to come here. And it's not just about basic access. It's actually about content and service and putting it up there, which would be just amazing.
Well, I think now it's time to finalize. So I will ask you, I want to finish our conversation with the topic regarding, let's say, the future of the internet. How the satellite networks are going to interplay with the traditional cable networks as we know now, and also the interplay with the 5G and the future of 5G. I think you mentioned it before, but maybe we could kind of wrap up with this.
Well, the issue is, if you're in a densely populated area, satellites aren't going to help you. You know, they're just too far away and there's not enough bandwidth. So that if you're all living, you know, downtown Tokyo, Amsterdam, whatever, Paris, satellites are really not useful, because you just can't get that much spectrum down there. They're very good for almost everywhere else. In the middle of the ocean, you know, remote areas, etc., they're just fantastic because they provide an astonishingly good service no matter what. But you asked a subtly different question, which is the future of the internet. And I would actually argue right now, from a point of view of traffic and the bulk of the traffic, there's only one internet left, and it's your access network. The internet now goes from you across the access network to the closest data center, which for many, many people in the world is in the same city that they're in. All the densely parts of the world are phenomenally well equipped with data centers. And what that means is there is no network. We provision just in case. Everything is fast because it's close. Everything is efficient because it's close. Everything is cheap because it's close. Everything works because we eliminated the long haul network. And now you're just doing haulage across a few kilometers. What does that mean for things like Starlink? And the answer is, I think, you've got to put petabytes of data up there. You've got to turn it into the Star CDN, you know, the content distribution network with distribution across the world, you know, from space. If you did that, then you're citing everyone who isn't close to a data center on the same terms, with the same performance, and interestingly, even the same economics as folk living in densely populated, well-serviced areas today. And so the future is not in the comms, the future is in the services you can load up there. And instead of looking at these satellites as something you bounce off and come back down to Earth, if you're able to provision storage, very, very high storage up there, then in essence, it's just a conversation between the satellites and their clients on Earth. Will we get there? In the fullest of time, we will. You know, we just will. That's obvious. How quickly? I don't know. I'm sure there are folk in Starlink who are dreaming and thinking about this, because why wouldn't you? It's just so obvious.
The emergence of this groundbreaking technology, what it will mean for the people who run the internet? That's my last one.
I think the folk who actually are the hyperscalers run today's internet. Because like I said, everything is CDN to customer. So what will this mean for Google, Meta, Apple, etc.? Cynically, I just say it means more customers at lower cost. But what does it really mean? You know, there's kind of two internets out there. And certainly the internet of my youth, which had much more grander visions of seeing a public communications network as something that would help us with grand challenges, would actually be of material assistance to allow us to grapple things like climate change, things like, various forms of economic divide, etc., to actually tackle some of the issues that I think are a product of ignorance and a certain amount of a sort of blinkered vision with a broader vision of humanity and our role on the earth. But those lofty views have been taken over by YouTube, Facebook, TikTok, and I'm not sure there's any of that vision left, to tell you the truth. We had such dreams for the telephone network. There was someone who was saying loudly in about 1885, after being introduced, that the telephone would be used for the president to talk to the people, important concerts to be sent around the nation. And you'd laugh, but they looked at the telephone and they dreamt of sort of the telephone uplifting an isolated community where communications was difficult, expensive, and rare. And what did we end up using the telephone for? Gossip. Just nothing. Today's internet is pretty tawdry. Pictures of cats, it's hardly edifying. And if the folk who produce pictures of cats run the internet, then, God help us all, because we're doomed. I'd still like to think that somewhere behind all of this, we're more than a YouTube feeder network. We're more than Meta. We're more than social networking. That somewhere there is the germ of what true communication was actually meant to be about information and the resource. If you strip away the ads, if you strip away the crap, Google search is amazing. The entire repository of human knowledge is available within about 750, milliseconds. Under a second, you tap into a core of knowledge which 10 years ago would have taken an army of researchers not to find. But somehow I think we've kind of pushed it into the, oh, it's boring bucket. It's not. And that resource is an astonishing resource. And maybe the issue is we just don't appreciate it enough. Because it is amazing. And sometimes you just sit back and think, I just asked Google an impossible question. It got the answer. Wow, that's cool. I think the internet has enduring value. It's just a case of searching through the dross to get there. And that's not a governance problem. That's the way we regard it kind of problem. And as long as we keep that level of, I don't know, amazement or and understand that beyond all the ads and cat videos is actually an astonishing resource, we'll be fine.
Well, it was a very nice ending, so I'm not even going to comment, but I think we are in the forefront of the communication revolution.
Oh, we're
Yes.
living it. We're living it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for this conversation. I learned a lot. I think the information that we will put out there is not a garbage. It's something actually very valuable. So this is a good information that people need to Google.
Excellent.